So we're in week three of session 11, and we're reading in Visions of Knowledge. The reading for this week was all from Visions of Knowledge, and next week we'll read a little more from Visions of Knowledge. I'm always impressed when I return to Visions of Knowledge. It somehow gets ignored quite a bit, but there's just wonderful material in it. So today, we had two different readings, and of course that's always a little difficult because to really go into one reading and reflect on it and what it's about is that's a good thing to do in a single session. To try to deal with two readings is challenging. I will try to integrate the two and we'll see how far we get. We start with a theme that we have certainly explored many times, and that is that our vision, our understanding of knowledge is very closely connected to a particular model. And that model is that there is a self that owns experience, as it says here, and that knows the world. Right? It says here, a subjective knower takes possession of knowledge in an objective world. That's on page 83. That's our model. That's how we understand things to work. And we're so committed to that model, and we've looked many times at why it is. Why we're so committed. Most recently, we've been talking about the witness. That's what we did last week. The witness tells us that's the way things are, and we accept the testimony of the witness. But in fact, the witness is just telling its own version. It's telling a story, if you want to put it that way. And then we accept that story. We live in it. We inhabit it. It's as though we were characters in a novel that hadn't been written yet, and as the author starts to write the novel, we don't really have any choice. We just take up our place in the story of the novel. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking of this for the first time because I don't know anything about it really, but there's a phenomenon on the internet where people write fan fiction, where they write their own stories about popular characters. And you could say, well, somebody else could write a different story. We could maybe set out to write a different story, and that's sometimes what happens in a sense. And again, I'm just saying this casually. I haven't thought about it. But in a sense, you could say that a conversion experience is something like that. We start to tell a different story or live a different story. Now, I know I'm oversimplifying, but I'm just trying to give you a sense. Remind us of what's going on here. So we're very committed to this story. Part of what TSK is about is encouraging us to find ways to let go of our commitment to the story. And of course, one way to do that is through practices. So the practice for this week, awareness as a reflective surface, And the whole series of practices, and there'll be more for next week, but in TSK 29, 30, 31, they're all about letting go of or questioning or investigating this sense that the way knowledge arises is when a subjective knower knows an objective world, and that would include those internal events too, our own emotional states and so on. That's our starting point. That's what TSK wants to challenge, let's say. And exactly how you go about that challenge is what we've been exploring and what we're also going to be exploring today. So There's a kind of alternative model presented at the very beginning, and that is the idea that, let's look at it, it's in the second paragraph on page 83, suppose that knowledge is not mine to possess, that instead of being confined in here with the self, knowledge infuses all appearance. Is there any way to make sense of this possibility? So that's a kind of alternative model. You know, if you're thinking in TSK terms, you might say, well, eventually, you know, it's not just a model, it's not just something, some different version that the witness is going to testify to, or some kind of fan fiction. Knowledge is universally available. There's a kind of a universal knowingness, as the TSK books say sometimes. So there is no need for a witness, or you could think about a witness in the way that we talked about it in the first week. Experience is its own witness, or experience, it's not the best word, but let's say the experience, the arising of what arises, is infused with knowledge. That's really what's being said here. And so the question gets asked, is there a way we can work with that? And one thing I think you could say, and that we've been looking at, is if we want to challenge the ordinary model, we need to have a reason for doing so. We need a motivation. I laugh because I'm thinking that's kind of like a novel, too, or a play, you know, with the stereotype of an actor who says to the director, wanting to play the character, he says, well, what's my motivation? You know? So our motivation is to break through limits, to find a kind of freedom. There's a nice line that I thought of when I was reading this from Love of Knowledge, and we've talked about it before. It's on page 112 of Love of Knowledge, and he's talking about polar knowledge. So polar knowledge is the kind of ideal version, the basic model of a subject knowing an object, the two poles, right? And in Love of Knowledge, Rinpoche writes, investigating polar knowledge means asking whether we are free. Asking whether we are free. So it's a big deal. If we live in a world where we're the knower and the world is available to be known, and if we then start to see how our knowledge as a self is conditioned by our own background, our own understanding, our own training, the language we use, all of that, then it starts to look as though our knowledge is inherently limited, and we can never break out of those limits. So that's a motivation. We would like to be able to break through the limits that we experience in the world. Well, another way to say that is we were looking for a knowledge that doesn't depend on the past. You know, knowledge that's kind of free and open and new in every moment. Sudhi writes in the chat box, our love of knowledge can be our motivation. Yes, absolutely. We need, for that, I think we need to have some sense of the possibilities for knowledge. And of course, that the TSK books try to give us that sense. So, you know, there are many ways to think about the, you know, why we would want to break through the normal model, because, you know, most people don't do it. Most people it never even occurs to them they can. We see a possibility, but we want to understand what the value of it is. So yes, love of knowledge. Yes, our sense that we want to be free, that we don't want to be committed to the past, and that's the another move that's made here in the reading. We want to be able to know without reference to the past. It says right on page 84 at the end of the first full paragraph, right now, without reference to the past or the patterns of the human mind, the ways we've developed of using our mind, right? Without those, knowledge may allow for something entirely different. And at the end of the next paragraph, he puts that in a nice way. He says, could we invent a new mind? That wouldn't just be another model. You know, it's not just we've got our mind right now, and then you know, imagine that it's made by a computer or that it is a computer, and then we introduce the latest new model. No, it would be a mind that was not limited in the way that our minds are limited. So it's this limitation. There are other ways to think about this motivation, and I'm spending some time on this because, you know, our interest here is in really activating the vision, although as we will see, Rinpoche questions that way of saying it. But that's how we've been thinking about it. So, you know, what leads you to activate the motivation? So Ken gives another reason here. It might be motivation might be to relax the unneeded effort of the witness, to ease the strain. Yeah, so one of the things we did in the walkabout last week, and we had looked at it in the previous phone call too, was we kind of looked for the feel of our experience. And there's a sense, you know, that what you discover may be a kind of a strain or unneeded effort, or there may be a kind of dis-ease, or there may be a feeling of something incomplete or missing, or a kind of alienation. There's many different forms, many kinds of negativity that you know, it's good to become familiar with. Not because we want to make ourselves feel bad. I mean, presumably the feeling is there all along. We're not creating something new. But to become aware of it so that... well, for two reasons. One is so that we're motivated to do something different. And the other is that the very act of becoming aware of our own sense of limitation or alienation, let's say, is already a new kind of knowing. So we could talk about incompleteness, frustration, limitation. That's a part of the issue. And then there's something else that the reading adds, which is that it's just so repetitive. We just keep having the same kinds of thoughts, the same kinds of experiences, the same kinds of, find ourselves in the same kinds of situations. So the reading talks about a deadly repetition that's at the bottom of page 85. It's just, and that's another way in which we say, well, this, how can we go on with this? You know, there are certain hard truths about human existence. You know, Buddhism talks about suffering, of course, and it talks about old age and sickness and death. And those are hard truths, for sure. And that's one way of looking. Here, it may be that, but it may also be this kind of underlying sense, you know, of limitation, alienation. Sudhi offers another word, contraction. Yeah, that somehow, you know, we're living in a small corner of the range of possibilities. And Ken offers another take. Experience becomes a real drag, right? It's a nice, that some of you may not know that expression, I mean, if you're not native English speakers. But it's got the drag, I think, has the sense of friction, you know? It's like we're always having to work hard to get to just sort of feeling basically okay, you know? At best. You know? And of course there are positive experiences, of course. And then what happens is they pass and we find ourselves wishing they were there and we hold on to them and now we have more frustration and it, you know, everybody understands something about this, I think, and it's good to be clear about it. So the question is, what do you do about that? That's always the question, you know, in DSK. How do we approach that? So in this reading, the text talks about two different possibilities. This is on page 83. Two ways of looking at the mind, one, or working with the mind. One would be to realize that our usual ways of knowing are limited, and there are other kinds of knowing that we could explore. That's fine. That's one approach. And then the second one he describes as a more radical approach, but it's still looking at the same thing. And that more radical approach is more to go directly to the sense that the knowledge that could break through these limits, the knowledge that, you know, that whose love could motivate us, is already there, is already available, that to use the expression that we already saw, that knowledge infuses all of experience. So that's a more radical way of saying it, but we're pointing toward the same thing, right? We're looking for ways to make knowing newly available, or, as we said, to invent a new mind. So one way we do that, and we'll come back to this later, but this is in the second part of the reading for this week, is we kind of give up our commitment to our ordinary knowledge, and instead we allow ourselves not to know. We allow for not knowing. And what that means we'll get to in a little bit. There's a different kind of knowing, a different kind of, and because it's different from the point of view of ordinary knowledge, it's a not knowing. You know, it doesn't count as ordinary knowledge. So what can it be? It has to be not knowing, right? But in fact, you can look at it and see it very differently. So we have this wish to know. And this is a point that Rinpoche makes on page 85. He says, you know, this is natural to human beings. So on the one hand, you'd say, well, maybe we're afraid to expand the range of our knowing. We'll talk about that a little bit. But at this point, Rinpoche is being more positive. And he's saying we've always wanted to know more. Right? That's the human condition, is to know more. If you were an evolutionary biologist, you'd say, well, you know, that's how human beings have survived. They have that drive to know more. I don't find that the most interesting way to look at it, but that might help. But one of the things that Rinpoche says here is technology and the kind of knowing that we rely on now, which is a kind of, you know, very structured, very cause and effect kind of knowing, is one expression of this wish to know. And I think that's one reason that Rinpoche uses the word knowledge. We've talked about this before. Sometimes people say, why don't you talk about time, space, and wisdom? Or, you know, maybe there are other candidates. But I think Rinpoche uses the word knowledge because he really wants to emphasize the connection between our ordinary understanding of knowledge, which is limiting, and the possibility for new ways of knowing, if we develop a real love of knowledge, or if we let ourselves experience that. And of course, you know, science, which is limited in its ways of knowing, nonetheless, scientists, I've been told again and again, and I've read occasionally, you know, scientists are motivated by a love of knowledge, or by wonder, by just wanting to understand. And that is very much consistent with the approach that we're taking here. At the same time, though, of course, we can't just go about doing things the way science does them, or technology. Rinpoche talks here about technological knowledge, which is a term that comes up in Love of Knowledge. He says we have to leave, on the top of 86, we have to leave technological thinking behind. Why? Because technology sustains the limits we wish to set aside. Still reading. Mm-hmm. Technology is for serving the self, the needs of the self, the wishes and wants of the self. And so it presupposes a certain kind of knowing, and you're never exactly going to be able to get outside it. Another way of saying that is that technology is committed to the subject-object structure, to polar knowledge. And of course, that's the whole structure. If you read anything about the scientific method, you know, of course, that's presupposed. It's, in that sense, science doesn't really depart from our everyday understanding. So that's problematic, because again, if you accept all of that, then you have to accept the fact that knowledge arises out of the past, it arises out of our conditioning, our our hard wiring in the brain and so on. And then you come up with all these issues about what counts, or well, let's just say about freedom, about human freedom, right? Because if we're completely dependent on the past, then we're completely conditioned. And it's interesting, I saw a movie about 10 days ago, I think, called Ex Machina. It's about artificial intelligence, and it's an interesting movie. It's a little bit, it's kind of an upsetting movie, I thought. But what it shows you very clearly is if you have a worldview in which the only kind of knowledge that's available to you is this past-centered descriptive knowledge in which the subject who knows is conditioned by what everything that comes before, it's a kind of a nihilistic view. Another way of saying that is, you know, when you talk about artificial intelligence, we're normally, when we say use that term, normally we're talking about robots and building machines that can act as though they were intelligent. But there's a certain sense, and a little bit this comes out in the movie, that the intelligence we usually rely on is itself artificial. I mean, there's no real knowing, you know, it's just wiring in the brain. So those kinds of issues come up there, but you know, we can't go into them too much. We don't have to go into them too much, but the point is that the kind of intelligence we rely on, the kind of knowing we rely on, is this profoundly limited kind of knowing, and we'd like to go past that. Philip has a comment here. He says the motivation could also be to stop living the whole concept of limitation. Yeah. What might happen, or what does happen occasionally, if we drop the whole idea of limits, separations, etc.? Perhaps the realization that we are simply an integral part of knowledge, he questions simply, the realization that we are simply an integral part of knowledge, and so with direct access to all of it through an instantaneous and universal neurological network, of which our brains might be a few of the elements. Well, right. I think that's exactly where the second part of the reading especially gets us to. I might question a couple of the ways you've phrased this. Well, one in particular, you say we have direct access to all knowledge. There isn't a someone, you know, who has that direct access, you could say. There is a kind of universal knowingness. And yes, we can... we're a part of it, and so somehow we somehow have to make that move to be able to experience that. So yes, somehow gain access to it. That's what it kind of seems like before we do it. And then when you talk about a neurological network, I'm okay with people talking about it that way if that seems interesting and helpful to you. It's at the level of explaining how this would all work, and I never think that explanations get to the heart of what's going on in TSK. But, maybe in the end that will prove, or maybe for you right now, that will prove a very fruitful way of thinking about it. I personally haven't found it so fruitful, but that's okay. Okay. So, that leads actually to where we are in the reading right now, because what Rinpoche says here, we're still on page 86, I think. Let's see, I can't find it right now. Oh, here, okay. Rinpoche says, all of our approaches, so if we say, well, how can we gain access, just to borrow your term, Phil, how can we gain access to this deeper knowledge? We're already thinking in terms of a self, right? So he says, in the second full paragraph on that page, he says, when we speak of refining knowledge or discovering new knowledge or even of activating a new vision, we tacitly adopt the limits of technological thinking. We depart from real knowledgeability, for knowledge by its nature will always be freely available. So, in other words, we don't have to do anything. But it looks like we do. You know, that's from our starting point. It looks like we do. And I was surprised when I saw this phrase. I didn't remember this. And he says, even when we talk about activating a new vision, yeah, right. We don't. There isn't anything. You know, we don't need to make the situation better. The situation the way it is, or the knowing that's available the way it is just fine. And yet, we kind of struggle because we always fall back into our story. We just always fall back into our story. So what do? Well, we clearly don't develop a technology, right, or a technique. That would be a big problem. But there are many possibilities for what we could do. And this will lead us into the second section. But I do want to point out there's really this first section that we read from Visions of Knowledge has so much in it. So it offers some possibilities for what we can do. You know, let's start by talking, again, a reminder, last week we were looking, kind of trying to discover the places where the limits seem very real, or the sense of dissatisfaction or frustration seems very real. And doing that, if we go to how that feels, to the feel of that, that very touching it opens it. So, the reading says at the top of page 87, not actually in this context, but he says, he talks about the power of our own active presence and potential. So if we let ourselves feel the whole of what we're feeling, then maybe we're coming in contact with that power and potential. So that would be one approach, and we've worked with that. There's a very interesting other approach. Maybe we'll go into this as a walkabout. At the bottom of page 86, he says, even if we think in technological terms, and he says, you know, we're kind of stuck with this because we have our story that we're engaged in, inhabiting. Even if we think in technological terms, we can challenge the attitudes and intentions that technology serves, the superficial patterns of wanting and desire the self takes for granted. So this goes to the notion that technology is about satisfying or fulfilling the needs of the self. And he's saying, well, what if we challenge that part of it? You know, we didn't challenge the limits on knowledge, but we challenged our usual motivations. So that would kind of go back to Sudhi's point about love of knowledge being the motivation. But here he takes it in a different direction. He says, saying not wanting and desire, and then he says, instead of always asking what we can get, we can ask instead what we can contribute. So that's very interesting. That goes in the direction that we will explore in the next session of Great Love. It goes in the direction of kind of undermining the self's commitment to its own projects and concerns. So that would be a nice thing to investigate, right? And then I'm going to turn for just a moment to page 88, because there's actually a whole range of sort of TSK practices that are just packed into one paragraph here. You could do a whole retreat. You could certainly do a retreat based on this section, but really almost on this paragraph. He says, the bottom paragraph, he says, the availability of time within experience means that we begin, and there's a typo here, there's a word left out, we begin to touch time when we investigate experience. So, okay, that doesn't tell us too much, how do we investigate experience, but it's pointing. In the same way, we discover space when we look with fresh eyes at the way that matter appears, and we activate knowledge when we ask how the mind takes form through thoughts and perceptions. Space, time, and knowledge are not abstractions, they are the reality of our lives. So this is a kind of summary of some things we've just been talking about, some of the ways you might activate the vision. I'm using that term knowing that Rinpoche says it's not ultimately an accurate way of talking about it. So it's you know, there's many things you could do there, and we've been talking about them. This whole section, as I was just saying, from, you know, starting on page 87, but when I say this whole section, I actually mean the kind of subsection here that starts on page 87 called Immediacy of Time, Space, and Knowledge. It's just a beautiful presentation of some fundamental points in the TSK vision. When I was reading this, I thought, boy, if I had this in my mind when I was editing the book Inside Knowledge, I might really have included this. But then I kind of wonder, because it's very compact, it's very condensed, and I think we can read it, you know, have with the background we have, we can certainly read it and say, boy, I can see how to work with this. But someone who's just trying to find their way into the vision, I'm not sure that would be the case. Okay, we have a few more comments. So Phil comes back and he says, wouldn't we can contribute? So I said, okay, we can ask how we can contribute. Wouldn't that imply that we are separate from knowledge in some way instead of being part of it? Yes, it would. So there is no good formulation, you could say, and Rinpoche keeps giving different formulations. I think the point of saying, well, we could ask what we can contribute is a way of deactivating the motivations behind the stories of the self. And when you do that, then you open up more to some possibilities. But it's not, right, it's not a final statement. It's not even maybe very accurate. But it's one of the reasons I wanted to call attention to it is because it's on the level of feeling. As I said, it kind of points in the direction that we can look at with appreciation, which we've talked about, or love. I think it's a mistake to leave those elements out. And sometimes when people study TSK, they do tend to leave out the affective side. Not such a great word, but that feelingful side. So that's the benefit of doing it that way. Okay, Michael says, as a poor student, slow reader, and a generally uncurious person, you wouldn't have stuck it out this long, Michael, if you were really generally uncurious, I don't think. Okay, but I'll accept your formulation, that's your story. And a generally uncurious person, my sense of knowledge is mostly a hope that limitation might melt if I stop projecting false notions onto my experience. The active inquiry that seems central to the TSK vision seems to describe a vigorous questioning mind. I wonder if a more meandering exploration of life as it arises, perhaps daring to hope that it might be different, can also be a fruitful response. Okay, well, that's interesting. I'm going to put some words in your mouth. Maybe instead of saying generally uncurious, maybe you'd say you have a tendency to be lazy. That's only a story, too. I mean, I think laziness is you know, there is no such thing as a kind of characteristic of a person. Oh, that's a lazy person. No, it just means that we put our energies in some places and not in other places. And then with respect to those other places, we say, well, I'm not interested in those, I don't do them, I'm lazy. But what you're suggesting is, you know, active inquiry sounds too hard, it sounds too challenging, too vigorous. And I wonder whether whether our inquiry could just be a more, meandering is a nice word, sort of wandering, looking, you know. I think potentially that's okay as long as, and you know, none of us, I don't think, is constantly engaged in this vigorous questioning that TSK is asking us to do. And it's kind of, it's a puzzle as to why. We've talked about that before, because it seems to bring such benefit and people experience it as beneficial. But we don't do it. We keep falling back into the old ways. So, asking in a kind of loose, open way, I think is certainly valuable. It's better than not asking at all. But still, you would like to be able to go to what Rinpoche says, and now this is from the second part of the reading, it's on page 162, he says, observe in every instance. Observe in every instance. So if that quality of observation, and of course the word observe is also a limiting word because it presupposes subject and object, right? But if you have a kind of low-key way of investigating, a kind of a, well, I wonder about this, you know, what if, that's fine, that's useful. It's especially useful if one way or another, whether you're doing that or vigorously questioning or doing a TSK exercise, one way or another, you are observing in every instance. Yeah. That seems to be, to me, to be more important than wondering, you know, whether this particular approach is fruitful or not. It's like saying, you know, if you say to yourself, well, I have to get some exercise, and so sometimes you go to the gym, you know, and you exercise, you ride a bicycle, or you run, or you swim, and that's vigorous, right? But then sometimes you just go out for a walk. And if it's a, you know, if you're walking kind of briskly, maybe that's better, but either way, it's exercising, you know? So certainly what you say, Michael, about an exploration of life as it arises, that seems to be really important, because whatever comes up presents these opportunities. So Ken asks, what about doing inquiry into the mechanism of projecting? Yeah, well, all the mechanisms of the mind that gets mentioned here, but you know, how does our ordinary knowledge arise, and what are the mechanisms, the processes through which we make meaning? Seeing that as a way, definitely, of going to the limits. Okay, so what I want to do now is turn toward the second part of the reading, and that will lead us to a fairly short, as usual, practice, but in the second part of the reading, the focus is really on not knowing, right? And one way that Rinpoche talks about that, a place we'll start, is on page 157, right at the beginning of the reading, where he says, he talks about a pre-existing body of knowledge, out of which the knowledge we discover emerges. So the discovery that he's talking about here, I think, is not like the discovery when we're doing some TSK inquiry. It's more as we become human beings, as we grow up, for instance, but it's, you know, keeps repeating itself. As we do that, we discover that things are a certain way. In other words, we get clear on we make sense out of things. I think that's what he's talking about here with discovering. So we have this knowledge that we've discovered to be the case. We've made sense out of things. We have our ordinary patterns, right? And what Rinpoche is saying here is that underneath or around or within, really everywhere, sort of globally available, there is a body of knowledge. And the knowledge that we discover emerges out of that body. And the way that connects into not knowing is that that body of knowledge is, by definition, unknown. So you can start with the feeling of not knowing. So in other words, we have our knowledge, and it's emerged in a certain way. Projection is one mechanism, but in various ways, our way of making sense out of things, that ordinary kind of knowledge, that has emerged. And if it's not part of that body of knowledge, we don't know anything about it. But that doesn't mean there isn't anything there to know, although the word anything, you know, is a little bit too limiting. But it doesn't mean that there isn't some fundamental knowingness or knowledgeability at work. But for us, it's unknown. So if we can practice with not knowing, as that becomes the source of knowledge. So if you look on page 159, that's exactly what he says in the end of the second paragraph. He's talking about the creative play of manifestation of what shows up. But he says we don't really have any good access to it, and so we don't really contact that creativity in a very fruitful way. And then he says, when we consider not knowing as simply the absence of knowledge, we lose sight of not knowing as the creative source of the known. So that not knowing is not different, I don't think. Maybe there'd be something to say. From this idea of a all-encompassing body of knowledge. And we can tune into that, and the way to tune into that is by going to the not knowing that is underneath and around and within and you know, any way you can say it, what we do know. So that's what I'd like us to do as a practice now for 5 minutes, okay? We've already talked about the importance of doing this in every instance, but I think for 5 minutes you'll probably stay pretty tuned in. So if you start with the, you know, here we are, you're in a situation, and actually more important, I think, than focusing on the things around you or the identities that you assign, it's really easier, again, to go to the sense of the field. You know, we know what's going on. We have a feel for what's going on. And the source of that is not knowing. Let's see what happens if we explore that possibility. So let's do that for 5 minutes. Okay, so let's come back. And of course, I invite your comments and questions and reports and so on, as usual. So I suppose the question that I would ask is there something when you go to that level of not knowing, is there something that becomes newly available, or does your ordinary knowing appear in a new light? Maybe you could say it that way. Those are the kinds of questions that come up for me anyway. It's a very interesting kind of question. You know, there's this sentence on page 159 where he says, ignorance can be the source of inspiration. And that's so different. But that's because, you know, our version of ignorance, it's so different from what we usually think. And that's because our version of ignorance arises within a very limited sense of knowing. You know? This is a different ignorance. This is the body of knowledge of which we are ignorant ordinarily, but that doesn't make it dead space. Okay, we have a few comments here. Sudhi says, allowing for not knowing feels to me being at ease, not focusing or contracting. Often no epiphanies happen. Right, you know, I mean, epiphanies are nice, but that quality of being at ease, I mean, you know, there's a certain sense, and maybe this goes a little bit back to Michael's description of meandering through life, you know. If we could let go of our strong commitment to what we know to be true, there would be a relaxing, there would be a releasing, there would be an opening, and we might just find ourselves, let's say that became our usual way of engaging the world, we might find ourselves, in a sense, meandering through life. Of course, that doesn't mean, that we wouldn't do things, that we'd always just be taking it easy. That might not be the right response. But there'd be a kind of a looseness, a allowing ourselves to enjoy and appreciate all of that. Klaus says, choosing the unknown seems to be equivalent to choosing space instead of objects. I think that's right. You could talk about these things in terms of space and choosing space instead of objects. You could talk about them in terms of time, you know, whether, I guess you'd say something like choosing the dynamic of time instead of the linear unfolding of time. Here we're talking about knowledge. I think I'll leave it at that. Eliana says, I always refer to what I've already known to understand my experience. This not knowing can be, as said in the book, the freedom from knowing what is laid out in advance. In other words, I can drop old suppositions to bring new knowledge. Yes, that's very nicely put. We talked about it at the beginning of the phone call today when we talked about descriptive knowledge, right? And in love of knowledge generally, which is where that term comes from, Rinpoche really emphasizes that our knowledge is centered in the past. And he invites, this is maybe more in dynamics, he invites a knowledge that is centered in the future, in the always arising. Right? So, I think that when we can tune into that sense that we're just kind of going with what we already know to be the case, then we realize that's hardly a knowing at all, or a very limited kind of knowing. Hayward says, the unknown seems to be a field of light from which the known appears. This light appears at birth, prior to being taught what to know. Right. So, you know, again, I don't know about the biology, but I mean, that's not where I want to go. Yeah, you know, we will be looking later I think in this session, at light, the relationship between light and knowledge. So, yeah, there's a kind of illumination, I think. You know, the body of knowledge, going to the unknown before everything gets put in place, and of course before is a little bit limiting, but I hope you understand what I'm trying to get at. When we go to that, yes, light, you know, many possible ways of engaging. So I think that's a good place to look, and we will look at it more later. Michael says, not knowing seems to be used as more fundamental than either ignorance or ordinary knowing. That's right. Although he does have what I just quoted here, where he says ignorance, I don't have it right, I can't find it right away. But he does use the word ignorance in a pretty positive way here. But generally, I think you're right. It's more fundamental. I wonder why we don't have another word for the source and environment of what we do know, a word more evocative of fecundity, birth, a surrounding coherence that allows us to know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be interesting to find a word that that doesn't commit us to a certain understanding of what we can know, but still allows for the possibility of knowing. I think knowingness is a word that is kind of like that. And I will say something that, I don't want you to take this as a comment on a very fundamental Mahayana Buddhist teaching, but I was thinking actually about the word shunya, which is empty, or shunyata, emptiness, which gets used as something fundamental in the Mahayana tradition. And people often point out that on the one hand, you could translate that as empty in the sense of, you know, there's nothing there. So what we ordinarily know is not there. But it also has the sense, the Sanskrit word has the sense, of being completely full, completely rich, completely like pregnant, actually. You talked about fecundity. So maybe that helps point a little in the direction that you're pointing at. Rinpoche is always looking for different words. If we come up with any, great. Ken says, allow for the possibility that space can be the means of illuminating experience. Yeah, and again, illuminating brings us back to the notion of light. And there is a phrase, I think maybe it's in the foreword to this book, but I'm not sure, where Rinpoche talks about how when we get trapped in our ordinary ways of knowing, experience eludes illumination. One of those nice little word plays that you find in TSK. But that's exactly right. We would like to be able to illuminate experience. And space can do that, or not knowing can do that. And as Klaus said, space and not knowing are very, this kind of not knowing, this deeper not knowing, are very closely connected. And Karin says, mysterious, full of chances. Right. Yeah. Nothing is established, right? Nothing is fixed for certain. That goes in the right direction. Okay, let's stop there. I've kept you a little long. My apologies. But we'll continue to be exploring here. And I think it's next, for the next session, maybe the next class, maybe the one after that, the exercise about not knowing in TSK is assigned. You might look very carefully at the description of that exercise and see whether that's the kind of not knowing we're talking about here, what the relationship is between the two. Maybe they're exactly the same. Maybe something different that will help clarify what's going on. Okay, well, thank you, everybody. We'll talk next week.
Thank you, Jack.